A group hired by the Montana Public Service Commission has found that Northwestern Energy hasn't budgeted enough to maintain the 11 dams the company is trying to purchase. Good evening, I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates Carney, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. And signature gathers are out in force as the Friday ballot initiative deadline looms.
And later in the program, we have an interview with Aaron Parrott about his new book, Montana Then and Now. A consulting company hired to evaluate Northwestern Energy's planned $900 million purchase of 11 hydroelectric dams has questioned whether the proposal budgets enough money for operations and maintenance of the structures. The Montana Public Service Commission hired the Essex Partnership to raise any questions and detect any omissions that should be considered as part of the proposed purchase from PPL Montana. That's according to Bob Decker, public policy chief for the commission, speaking with the Great Falls Tribune. The analysis by the Essex Partnership relied on information provided by Northwestern Energy, not on-site analysis. The consultant questioned whether Northwestern's proposal included enough money for operations and maintenance as it calculates rates its customers would be expected to pay if the sale goes through. The analysis raised unfounded concerns, said William Rhodes, Northwestern Energy General Manager for Power Generation. The Essex Review, quote, was not conducted at the same level of completeness as the due diligence conducted by Northwestern Energy, unquote, Rhodes said, noting that Essex did not interview any PPL Montana employees, did not conduct site visits, and didn't have all the institutional knowledge of evaluators hired by Northwestern. PPL has spent $350 million on maintenance since it purchased the dams in 1999, said Northwestern spokesman Butch Larkham. The Montana Consumer Council, which represents the interests of utility customers, also believes Northwestern has underbudgeted its capital spending, which the council believes should be at $8.5 million in 2018. Essex consultants said the maintenance spending should be at $6.89 million in 2021. Northwestern put that figure at $4.21 million. Utility analyst Paul Schultz said the Consumer Council wants Northwestern to understand that shareholders, not ratepayers, should be held financially responsible if the company significantly underbudgets for operations and maintenance.
And in other news from around the state, a federal judge has given tentative approval to a reorganization plan for the bankrupt Montana Electric Cooperative. Southern Montana Electric Generation and Transmission Cooperative fell into bankruptcy in 2011 after getting locked into unfavorable contracts and building a natural gas-fired power plant near Great Falls that has sat idle. It serves more than 11,000 customers in central and eastern Montana. Court records show U.S. bankruptcy judge Ralph Krishner said Friday he intends to confirm a plan that would keep Southern Montana together for 4 years. The power plant would be sold by the banks that offered construction loans for the project. Some of the cooperative's creditors had objected to this plan. Southern Montana manager Scott Sweeney says their concerns were resolved through a recent settlement. Details have not been released.
The Billings City Council will hear more public comment at this hour as it continues to consider becoming the fifth major Montana city to adopt its own non-discrimination ordinance. That ordinance would make it illegal for a business, landowner, or an employer to refuse services to anyone for reasons related to sexual orientation or gender identity. There is currently no state or federal law that prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. The hearing comes after a record-breaking bout of public comment last Wednesday, with nearly 150 Billings residents waiting until nearly 6 a.m. Thursday morning to voice their opinions about the ordinance. Since then, public officials have been working to develop a more detailed ordinance with language similar to previously passed ordinances in other cities. One difference, however, is the inclusion of the word non-binary alongside the categories of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual. Nikki Zupanik, policy director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana, says the inclusion of the term would protect more people from possible discrimination than other similar ordinances.
Non-binary just means a person that doesn't identify with male or female, maybe somewhere in between, may identify a little bit differently. Their biological sex at birth doesn't match up with their gender identity. The gender that they identify with, how they express themselves, that can be different from their sex assigned at birth.
In her 6 years at the ACLU of Montana, Zupanik says the lack of non-discrimination legislation in Montana has led to significant underreporting of discrimination because many people are afraid it could cost them their job or affect their standing in the community. The current version of the ordinance would require people to use public facilities such as bathrooms as designated by their anatomical sex regardless of their gender identity. Zupanik says that exceptions like these aren't necessary and stem from a lack of awareness.
When they learn more about how transgender people are no more of a threat to safety and privacy than any other customer in a business. When they learn of the difficulty that transgender people face every day when it comes to using a public restroom or using a locker room, most people come around. We have three other Montana cities and more than 100 cities across the country that make sure that their ordinances provide transgender people with protections in a wide variety of facilities. And those ordinances have been working out just fine.
The Billings City Council has yet to set a date to vote on the ordinance. Bozeman, Butte, Helena, and Missoula have already adopted similar ordinances.
Sponsors of proposed ballot initiatives are scrambling in the final days before a Friday deadline to gather enough signatures to put their issues on the Montana voters to the Montana voters on the November 4th ballot. The Montana Secretary of State's office has approved a dozen initiative petitions for a signature gathering after they passed legal reviews by the Attorney General. Officials asked today they did not know how many, if any, would make the deadline. To make up the ballot, initiative must receive signatures from 5% of the total number of qualified voters in Montana, including 5% of the voters from each of the 34 legislative House districts. That comes to 24,175 voter signatures from across the state. There are also three proposed changes to the Montana Constitution that require signatures from 10% of the voters spread out among 40 House districts, which is 48,349 signatures. Two legislative referendums that don't require signatures will be on the November ballot. One calls for a constitutional amendment changing the name of the state auditor to the Commissioner of Securities and Insurance. The second one would end late voter registration the Friday before Election Day and voter registration on Election Day. The Montana Supreme Court blocked a third legislative referendum to advance the two top primary vote getters to the general election, regardless of party. The court ruled the title of the initiative that would have appeared on the ballot fell short of legal requirements.
Montana wildlife officials have come up with a short list of five entities that could receive bison from Yellowstone National Park under an experimental program to establish new herds of the animals. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesman Ron Osheim says the 145 bison have been held for the past several years on behalf of the state at a Bozeman area ranch owned by philanthropist Ted Turner.
The Green Ranch, which is owned by Turner Properties, because when we developed a quarantine procedure for bison that were captured in Yellowstone Park to see if we could create disease-free bison for conservation purposes, we looked and looked and looked for a place to put those and could not find one until the Turner Ranch, or the Green Ranch, offered to hold those for up to 5 years. And those are now, we've been asked to have those moved off by this November. It was just part of the agreement that they're ready to move on and do some other things with that piece of property. They had to keep those bison separate from any that they had.
They were captured from the park in 2005 and 2006, put into quarantine, and tested repeatedly to make sure they don't have the disease brucellosis. Osheim says those tests have produced some encouraging results.
Well, we've learned that we can create a disease-free bison, that's for sure. These have been tested, as I said, this all started back in 2005. These bison in question have been tested up to 10 times, and people agree that they're now brucellosis-free, and that's the good news.
10 entities offer proposals to take the animals. Osheim says they've narrowed that to 5 finalists.
Well, there were a group of technical experts representing private sector, federal government, state government, veterinarians, forage people, and that group recommended to be considered the Fort Peck Indian Reservation, that's the Assiniboine and Sioux tribes, the Utah Division of Wildlife for the Henry Mountains and the Book Cliffs. The Wildlife Conservation Society at the New York Zoo has some options to raise and then use bison or provide bison for conservation purposes. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, and then the American Prairie Reserve, which is in eastern Montana, north of the Missouri River. Those are the ones that are under consideration.
The Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department director will make a decision based on staff and committee recommendations. Environmental assessments will be prepared for any and all of those recommendations. Public comment will be taken, and a final decision should be made by mid-November.
When Montana Territory was established, it was land of teepees, ramshackle cabins of lawless vigilance, and hardscrabble miners. 150 years later, a new book, Montana, Then and Now, by Helena author Aaron Parrott, compares where we started with where we are today. Sheree Newman, producer of The Right Question, talked with Parrott about the book.
Although the residents had appealed to the federal government much earlier, the United States Congress did not approve their petition to establish the Montana Territory until 1864. Why did the people want the government, the federal government, involved, and why did Congress change its mind?
The people of the territory wanted federal intervention because of basically the rampant crime that had precipitated the rise of vigilantism in the famous vigilante episode. And they wanted a clear rule of law and closer proximity to the federal government in Washington. I think the federal government, and I have a great quote in there from Abraham Lincoln, who actually signed Montana into a territorial status, he was persuaded by the mineral wealth, by the discovery of gold. And the quote in there is something like, with the gold that we can take out of Montana, we could pay for this war.
Debates about development versus the environment have been an issue from the very beginning. What lessons from the past did you find when you were researching this book that we can apply to what's going on in our state today?
I think that the lessons of Butte are pretty obvious, and I think that many episodes of that kind of unchecked development where there's no responsible remediation have taught us that we need to be much more careful and prudent as we develop, especially mineral resources. And I think that that consciousness, coupled with an understanding that tourism is really the key to Montana's future economy, will, I think, help preserve the state for many generations.
You write a lot about the Constitution from 1972. Can you give us a brief summary of what you think is really good about it?
I can, and I would say I can do so in large part thanks to my interview with Arlene Reichert in Great Falls. You know, she gave me lots of information and some great anecdotes about that convention, but she thought one of the keys to its success was that even though it was made up of both Republicans and Democrats and a few independents, they did not meet separately. All of their discussions were unicameral. All 100 members of the delegation met together, and they agreed to never cut off discussion until they felt the issue had been settled. There just was a real sense of unification and community in spite of the fact that many of these people had very opposed viewpoints. And there's really three pieces of the Constitution that she was particularly proud of. One was the environmental protections. Two was a dedication to equal rights for women. And a third was a dedication to Indian education.
Can you say something about what is the same today that was happening in 1864? What about the breweries?
That's a really great point of comparison, that in 1864, every local community had its own brew house. And I think 1968 was when the last independent brewery in Montana closed for almost 40 years until the microbrew industry popped back up. And, you know, that was thanks in large part to Jimmy Carter. He introduced the bill to make it legal to homebrew beer again. And that's what led to the resurgence and the return of Great Falls Select Kettle House here in Missoula, Helena's Kessler Beer, Missoula Highlander Beer.
Something to be thankful to Jimmy for.
That's right.
Montana Then and Now is interesting, informative, and it's easy to read. It's not a dry, scholarly book. Aaron Parrott, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here.
In tonight's forecast, west of the Divide, there's a winter storm watch in effect from midnight through late Tuesday above 6,000 feet for the West Glacier region. Tonight and Tuesday, rain showers in the west of the Divide are likely, with lows in the mid-30s to up to mid-50s, In central Montana, there's a winter storm warning in effect from midnight tonight to 6 a.m. Wednesday for elevations above 6,500 feet for the Rocky Mountain front. Tonight, there's a chance of thunderstorms in the evening with rain showers through the night and a chance of thunderstorms after midnight with lows from 40 to 50. On Tuesday, it should be cloudy with rain showers and a chance of thunderstorms, highs 55 to 65. In southwest Montana tonight, expect rain showers and a chance of thunderstorms and snow showers in the evening, then rain showers and snow showers likely with a slight chance of thunderstorms after midnight, low 35 to 45. On Tuesday, more clouds with snow showers possible and thunderstorms likely, highs 50 to 60. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
The coal industry and its allies in the electric generating industry are pushing back against EPA's proposals to regulate the carbon pollution from coal-fired electric generators. A coordinated campaign is flooding the media with supposedly independent editorial comments, parroting familiar but false economic claims. Let's look at some of the more outrageous of these economic assertions. We are told that electric prices will be driven sky high, damaging all households and businesses. The U.S. Department of Energy is said to have confirmed a projected 13% increase in electric prices by 2020. Wrong. In dollars of constant purchasing power, DOE is projecting that electric prices will creep up a whopping total of 3% between 2011 and 2020 if there is an accelerated retirement of coal-fired electric generators. We are told that our energy independence is being threatened by restricting carbon pollution from the burning of coal. The Department of Energy projections show just the opposite, a steady decline in reliance on importing energy. In 2008, we were importing about 30% of our total energy consumption. DOE projects that will decline to about 5% by 2025, even with an accelerated retirement of coal-fired generators. We are on our way to becoming almost completely energy independent due to increased production of oil and natural gas, not coal. Of course, the very people who oppose regulation of carbon pollution also support boosting our exports of energy, driving American energy prices upwards, and increasing our energy dependence. We are told that coal is our cheapest and most efficient source of energy. That assertion, besides ignoring health and safety concerns with pollution from coal-fired generators, focuses solely on fuel costs, conveniently ignoring the huge capital costs required to convert coal into electricity. Simply burning coal does not generate anything useful. The coal combustion has to be contained in a boiler and the steam from it carefully moved through a turbine to generate electricity. Over a decade ago, long before EPA was talking about controlling carbon pollution, electric utility executives were already moving away from coal as a fuel to produce electricity because of the cost of building coal-fired generators was so high compared to the cost of building natural gas-fueled electric generators. When natural gas prices also tumbled downward, the economics were overwhelming. Coal could not compete. The coal industry and its allies should be pointing their fingers at markets and supply and demand rather than once again trotting out Uncle Sam as the perennial evil straw man. We are also told that EPA's regulation of carbon pollution from electric generators destroys all incentives for coal developers and electric utilities to design an effective means of capturing and storing carbon emissions. Apparently, the theory is that if there were no EPA regulation of carbon pollution, coal developers and electric companies would work hard to invest and innovate so as to reduce or eliminate that carbon pollution. Say what? If there were no restrictions on carbon emissions, why would anyone invest in controlling them? That is not how we reduce sulfur, particulate, and mercury emissions from coal-fired plants. We did not wish those reductions into existence and wait for electric generators to hear our whispers. We imposed limits, and our business community found ways of meeting those community environmental standards while remaining profitable. We are told that the effort to reduce the carbon pollution coming from American power plants will contribute nothing to overall levels of carbon emissions around the world, because our carbon emissions are a relatively small part of total worldwide emissions. In addition, we can expect that the rest of the world will continue to dump more and more carbon into the atmosphere because they, like us, have to in order to live a decent life. So we are told, we are shooting ourselves in the economic foot, if not the heart, for nothing. That is the well-known mantra of the committed free rider. As the president has made clear, the point of the United States doing something serious now about carbon pollution is so that we can speak with at least a tiny bit of moral authority to other nations of the world about collectively doing something about our collective carbon emissions that threaten all of us. If we all chant the free rider mantra and do nothing, then, of course, nothing will be done. And we can all loudly blame each other as the collective pot of water we all share is slowly brought to a boil. As hard-nosed game theory has repeatedly shown, the way to avoid the free rider catastrophe is to be nice, retaliate, but don't bear grudges. That is, we have to demonstrate ahead of time our willingness to cooperate at some risk of cost to ourselves. That is how human beings lay the basis for cooperation and moral progress, laying back, looking only at our own advantage, and waiting to exploit the goodwill or weakness of others is a dead end. That frame of mind would undermine plain ordinary commerce as well as a livable world.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Corin Cates-Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. Thanks for listening, and please join Editor O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.